lock yourself in your house. Viruses are killing everybody. A reality contestant runs the world government, essentially. Rich billionaires are deciding whether you can and cannot get access to medication that determines if you live or die. Listen, baby, it's the cyberpunk era. So strap in, you know, get down into your fortified bunker, arm yourselves, and warm yourself with Punk News Podcast episode 484. The countdown to 500 begins now. Back to the Punk News Podcast. I said the countdown to 500 begins now, and that's a surprise to Adam and Tom and myself, because we have done essentially no planning for 500, and I want to do something special, but I haven't thought about it at all. But the countdown begins
now. Wouldn't it be the count up to 500?
Well, I say countdown because it's, you know, 16 episodes.
I know, John. I'm just giving you a hard time.
So, Tom, yes. Are you getting excited for 500? Do you have good ideas in the works?
I have a lot of ideas, John. Most of which would probably result in one or all of us getting thrown in jail.
Well, that's a start. Adam White, should we go
to jail? Especially Canada. Those Mounties, man, they'll throw you in jail for just about anything, I understand.
Adam, should that be our episode 5? We go to jail in episode 500.
I can wear my hat.
Your hat? What do you mean your hat?
So, he's got a special jail hat.
I have a special jail hat. on the last B.A. Johnson record, there is a song about going to see Van Halen and doing a bunch of mushrooms and running from the security people.
What era Van Halen?
He actually mentions both in the song. The era of Van Halen is sort of part of the part of the lyrics. So I don't want to spoil
both
anything.
Gary Cherone and Sammy Hagar, you mean?
So
the two main eras.
The chorus of the song is, "We're all going to jail except Pete. He's going to die." And then, so BA's been touring behind this record. So he made a bunch of toques, or I guess, what do you Americans call them? What's your stupid American word for them?
The only reason I know the word toque is because that 12 Days of Christmas by the McKenzie brothers, they say 12 gold toques.
Honestly,
I don't know what that is.
For all of the Trumpiness and the wrecking the world and all that stuff, the fact that you guys call toques beanies is really the worst thing about the United States. So anyways, like a toque, like a woolen cap that you would wear in the winter. But he made like a really like obnoxious, really obnoxious one that I would see like my uncle wearing when I was a kid, like where it's got like a giant pom pom on top and it's about six sizes too big kind of thing. But stitched into the side of the toque, like knit into the side of the toque, it says, "We're all going to jail." And this is like a really like a bright orange, like really obnoxious hat. So I bought this from him at one of his shows, and it is my like go-to winter headwear. And my kids are all aware of it. So my daughter all the time when I'm wearing it is like, "We're all going to jail." And I'm like, "Yep, that's what the hat says." Anyways, I can wear that when we go to jail. Oh, 500. God. I mean, it's here's my problem. I'll admit this. I feel like some of our stunt episodes are the episodes that I would want to least listen to as a listener. So,
but I think that's good. I firmly stand by the proposition that you shouldn't always give the fans exactly what they want, which I think is a very good idea.
every 50 episodes, we had to challenge them. Are you sure this is something you still want to listen to?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
It's like jumping. This is a jumping off point, everyone.
Who's more interesting, the Bouncing Souls or the Melvins? Bouncing Souls, you get a great Bouncing Souls album every time. Melvins, sometimes you get the best album ever. Sometimes you get Sonic Chaos. Who's more interesting?
More interesting? Yeah, I'd say at this point, the Melvins are more interesting. I don't know about listenable, but interesting.
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens on 500. So yeah, so we're counting up to 500.
So we're
now.
Definitely going to have the Melvins and the Bouncing Souls on for number 500. Sweet.
Well, and the Bouncing Souls you just insulted, so they don't want to be on now.
Yeah, I beat down the Bouncing Souls too often. Like, just because, I mean, like the reason I beat down the Bouncing Souls is I like them generally, but they're making all the right safe decisions. You see, you know what I mean.
I prefer to go another generation newer, John, and pick on the Menzingers.
Well, I wouldn't put them in Bouncing Souls category because Menzingers have had albums that people say are bad and are boring, where Bouncing Souls just put out a Bouncing Souls album every time, you know?
Yeah, they put out a couple albums that are certainly on the borderline of being boring, but yeah.
Adam, remember when remember when Menzingers hated me?
Yeah, what did you do?
They still will after this episode.
I use them as my beatdown pad for my argument that punk rock is getting soft, boring, and wimpy. And it was unfair of me to use them as my sole example of that, because there's many bands that exhibit that. But I was like pinging them like every other week as an example, and it got to them. And I actually apologized in episode like 300 or something.
What was that? What was that boring ass band that they call their albums like LP1, LP2? They're from Philadelphia. Oh, Restorations.
They hated me too. It was the Menzingers.
They hated me also, John. They were not pleased with one of them. Reviews, and I actually thought I was being kind.
I'm surprised you reviewed that, but listen, we got a lot to do this week. And
you know why, John? You know why I did? Because there was this Canadian band that I just had heard so much hype about from this Canadian fella I know, and opening the show, and they were called the Dirty Nil, and they were actually really good.
See, I think the Dirty Nil are okay. I think they're okay.
I think, you know, it's funny because I loved that first LP. What was that called with the green smoke on it? What was the name of that one, Adam?
It was Blue Smoke, and it was Higher Power.
Higher Power. So I love that record, and then they put out another record, and I never bought it. How does that work? What happened that I was being very interested to all of a sudden I sort of indifferent?
Because they were giving the fans what the fans want every time. Unlike the Melvins, you never know what you're going to get. So you got.
I don't know about that. As opposed to like Pup, there was a couple bands from that era that Adam was constantly like forcing down our throats. The other one was Pup. I could never get into Pup.
Oh, really? Adam was forcing a Canadian band down our throat? Wow.
I know, it's unlikely.
Speaking of forcing Canadian music down our throat, Adam White had the thrill of going to a record convention. I myself went to the first true record convention I've been to in like I've been to like record convention type things, but I went to a true record convention for the first time in a couple of years, not counting Netherlands, like 4 months ago. And man, record conventions, I love record conventions so much. Adam White, were you at a record convention? Did you have fun? What'd you get? And how was it like all smelly dudes, or was it a good mix of normal people?
You know what? I found that the record weirdos at this last one that I was at were all charmingly like they were what you wanted them to be, right? They're these strange grizzled drifter looking guys, but were like very 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 amicable. Like I was fine with all of them. The problem was that they were actually smelly like patrons.
That's what I'm talking about. You know, the patrons are worse than the
sounds
are kind of
like I'm sitting there, like I'm going through the bin, and there's someone standing next to me going through the bin, and I'm like, woo, I'm like, I'm skipping the bees here because this dude is this guy is ripe and I want to be by him. So I had this moment at this record show that I thought of you guys for a moment, and then I feel like I totally failed at being really punk about anything, which is that so. I don't know if you've ever experienced a middle of the road record show in a small Canadian town, but
sure those are the only type I've ever experienced, Adam, if we're being honest.
Well, so there is a lot.
Take away the small Canadian town thing, of course.
Yeah, there's a lot of let's say like late 70s to early to mid 80s detritus that's there. Just like you see the same damn records over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I feel that like it is somewhat to do with like whatever would have been on like rock radio in, you know, Windsor in 1987, and it's a lot of that stuff. So there's a lot of that junk that you end up sort of like seeing again and again and again, and you're just like, I don't know, it it gets pretty monotonous. And even when you start to get into the stuff that they have like off, like earmarked and labeled as like specifically punk, it's just a lot of like repeats of the same shit here. Now in Canada, it's, or at least in this area of Canada, it's a lot of repeats of the same stuff when you get into the punk realm in particular, where like you will see the same Teenage Head record 15 times. Now Teenage Head was fun, but you know, like that's just, everyone had that record because it was important here. So, you know, over and over and over. But then I'm going through the bins at this one place, and I see there's this guy that has like a little tiny pile of 7 inches next to his stuff. And I start rifling through it, and it is like misfits after misfits after misfits after misfits, like just like 12, 13 misfits, 7 inches all in a row.
Bootlegs are real deal.
All bootlegs.
I don't know. Probably. Like they all,
if they're less than hundreds of dollars, they're all bootlegs.
They were less than hundreds of dollars and looked fairly clean.
Oh, bootleg. But is
that bootleg, are Misfits the kind of band that, and forgive me, I don't know this because I don't really keep up on what goes on in their business arrangements, but are they the kind of band that will just continuously shit out the same, like more pressings of the same 7-inch?
No, forever? All the original 7-inches were maybe a couple thousand copies, and that was it.
No, that's the astounding thing about the Misfits is they only did original presses, like 1, 2, 3 presses in like the early 80s. Those versions are different than the ones on the albums, and they've never repressed the 7-inches despite the high market demand. And then there are literally tens or hundreds of thousands of bootleg dollars worth of bootlegs, 7-inches out there, which Danzig is just kind of ignoring, which he could easily claim by putting out official versions, but he refuses to do so, which further makes Danzig a bigger mystery.
So these were not like pressing number 700 for Hot Topic in 2012. Yeah,
there was no Plan 69 records, Adam. Or Plan 6 records I've seen. There's all kinds of different funky like takes on Plan 9.
Okay, so I was not shunting my duties as a dutiful punk here to completely ignore those things and then go buy a bunch of Neil Young records.
No, you should have bought those Misfits bootlegs if they weren't too expensive. Because even those have a pretty decent value, honestly.
What turned me off of it was that it seemed like there were so many of them, and it seemed like they were so kind of new and clean that like it felt to me like I guess I'll bag on against me here, and I don't know why, but like no, but you can go like against me is a band that has like a huge, like as a modern band, has a pretty healthy amount of people that are collecting the records that they put out. But there are some of those 45s that they have that are not only readily available, but like were clearly printed in abundance. And you can walk into kind of like any given record store anywhere and, you know, close your eyes and throw a tennis ball, and you'll probably hit one of these Against Me 7-inches that are floating around. And, you know, I don't begrudge the band for that or anything, but it's just that there are a lot of them, and it's not that interesting from a, you know, from a collector's acquisition
standpoint. Not much of a thrill of the hunt.
Yeah. So, I've never hunted around for Misfit stuff because, again, I'm bad at being a punk rock guy. But it took me aback to kind of see all this stuff here, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, this is either, like, you know, some poor misguided person's, you know, amazingly pristine collection that is just sitting there on the table, or more likely it's a bunch of Hot Topic stuff. So you're saying it is a third thing, which is a pile of bootlegs.
Pile of bootlegs. Yes. Run.
There was like Hot Topic presses of Walk Among Us, but that, you got to remember, that was the only record that wasn't put out actually by the Misfits.
So I guess, well, we know now. Now we know. John.
You came to the right place, Adam, if you're looking for various Danzig and Misfits knowledge. I know we get complaints of, can't we go 1 week without mentioning Danzig or the Misfits? So it's kind of become a fun thing.
It was me this time that did it. So anyways, I didn't buy
those. Thanks a lot, Adam.
I didn't buy those because, man, you know what
you suck. You should buy them next. How much are we talking about?
don't know. These reached like I don't know, like 15, 20 bucks or something. I'm like,
yeah,
that's a little high. I mean, if they were 10 bucks a piece or less, I probably would have bought them all that I don't have. I have a few of those. But anyway, I mean, you were you. You do you, Adam. You go listen to Harvest.
Oh, I didn't buy Harvest. Come on. I bought a copy. I bought it like an OG copy of On the Beach, which is one of my favorite Neil Young records. Okay. And I bought a nice original kind of fucked up copy of Trans, which is if you listening to this podcast are not super up on like your Neil Young history, there came a period in the 80s where Neil was fighting with his record label.
Ah, but Trans is not a part of that.
Trans isn't a part of that, but it is part of. You can lump it in with that oeuvre of Neil fighting with his record label. Where basically there was this while where Neil got weird and difficult and had a little bit of a obsession
with. He got weird and difficult.
Yeah, I was going to say he's born weird and difficult.
Sorry, so he got
ornery.
I guess like aggressively weird and difficult, right? Like not just charmingly weird or passively weird, but aggressively weird. And Trans is one of, yeah, it's not one of those three records that he wrote when he was trying to get out of his contract and was just trying to piss them off. But it's definitely one where I'm sure a record executive looking for the next Harvest would have been pulling his hair out. It's Neil Young playing with like a synthesizer in some ways, the most obnoxious 80s ways that you could imagine.
I disagree with that characterization entirely.
You don't think that it's, there are songs on there that are have such an 80s view of computers. There are songs where he's talking about being a computer man through a vocoder voice.
Yeah, well, that's not. I mean, when people say obnoxious 80s, I think they think of like Phil Collins at his worst, or like Whitesnake.
I mean, as far as like the 80s perception of the technology, not as far as.
I will say, Adam, it's very much that's the thing that bothers you about the album, Adam White, that guy that works with computers all day. So I understand that, but I would say that album is flawless and amazing.
Oh, it's amazing. Don't get me wrong. It's just one of these things that like. You know, if you could take a fairly seasoned, you know, boomer age Neil Young guy and put Trans in front of him and he'd be like, what the fuck is this? So, yeah, it's.
See, that's why Neil is cool. He doesn't always give the audience exactly what he wants. And that's why he's still respected. And that's why people still care about what he's up to.
So anyways, I picked up a copy of that. But then I'm sitting here and I've mail ordered things and there are. There's something here that is of no interest to anyone but me, but I'm very happy I own it. And there's another one, John, that I just wanted to tell you about because it's just delightfully fucking weird. So there is there was a band that was around in the early 90s out of Toronto called John Ray and the River. And they're not a band anymore because I think John Ray, as I understand it, became a raging alcoholic and had to kind of quit the rock and roll lifestyle because it was going to make him die. But it's this band that does these like almost to the point of obnoxious gospely rock songs where he's yelping like a Southern preacher possessed throughout half these songs. But most of them are just about getting drunk or, yeah, they're mostly about getting drunk. I mean, it's pretty clear listening to this record, like why this guy had a substance abuse problem. But it's kind of fascinating. But no, that's not the one that I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is a split 7-inch that just came out this year from you'll know one of these bands, probably not the second. So, are you aware of who the Sadies are?
Yeah, I know the Sadies.
Are you aware of who King Khan is?
Yeah, I like King Khan a lot.
Okay,
I got a funny story about him. Maybe I'll tell another episode.
So King Khan. So King Khan lives in, he's originally one of these, like, he's a Montreal punk guy originally, like Montreal garage punk, but he lives in Berlin now. And that's where he lives and, conducts his strange orchestras and things like that. So King Khan and the Sadies got together and they put together a split 7-inch. Now the Sadies are a, alt country band out of Toronto, plays super intricate kind of like dueling guitars, kind of dark country stuff. Those guys were all in punk bands at one point in their life, and then they moved on and they had garage rock stuff, and that now they're doing their thing with the Sadies. Dallas Good from the Sadies actually plays guitar sometimes with Career Suicide, the hardcore band out of Toronto. But the Sadies themselves are like a super well respected, like, by other musicians and stuff like that. Kind of alt country thing right now. So the Sadies and King Khan made this 7-inch. King Khan's song is called Old Gunga Din. The Sadies song is called The Most Despicable Man Alive. And I didn't think really anything of this project when it was announced, except that I like both those artists. But when you go and you listen to this record, the Sadies side is about how Dallas Good, the vocalist guitarist in the Sadies, it's about how Dallas went and did acid with King Khan, who is the most despicable man alive in the title, and had some horrible trip because of this. And the King Khan side is about how King Khan gave Dallas Good acid and the resulting complications from this. And
that's funny.
It's both of them wrote a song that is directly like not even in metaphor, like directly calling out the other artist in the song lyrics about one specific incident that appears to be a bad acid trip, and they both sort of attribute the blame differently. And it's a perfect thing for a two band split 7-inch. Like, it's not just like two random leftover songs they put together. It is basically each band calling each other out about something. And
that's cool.
It is neat. So there's I don't know, there were a small handful of these suckers still available when I bought this one, but it's the kind of thing that I want on a 7-inch. Like, neither of these tracks are album tracks because they're too weird and too specific to the project. But, you know, as a strange little thing that's going to sit on my shelf forever, I'm totally down with this. So, yeah.
That's cool. That's good. The
other funny thing to me is that, so that John Ray record that I bought, that was a Discogs buy. And I bought it from some guy that had specifically listed it as being like, oh, this was part of a private collection and I've now had to downsize and stuff like that. And then when I ordered it from him, the guy was like super communicative and super, what is it? Like he was like overly cordial and everything when you're talking to him. And you get the impression where you're like, this is not some grizzled Discogs seller. Like this is a guy that's parting with his dearly beloved records that he has. So that one comes in the mail. It is in a box that you could have put like five LPs in. And he's done that thing that record collector guys do where they've shipped it because they've separated the cover from the record and they packed them separately. And the record is in one of those like acid free, like aftermarket sleeves that is not the original sleeve that it would have been in, because this guy clearly has all the records on his shelf, like repackaged into the most like, you know, museum preservation-y sort of way possible. Right. And so I get this. Oh, and this thing is, and then it is covered in tape in a way that I had to use a kitchen knife to get into it. And he's got like Fragile stickers all over the thing. It's like he sent me the Crown Jewels of England, essentially. Meanwhile, this Sadies King Khan record comes from the label. It's in a fucking manila envelope that you would use to mail like three sheets of paper to someone. They just jammed a hunk of like ripped up cardboard in there to hopefully blunt the damage from shipping. And I mean, it came out fine, but like, it's just hilarious the amount of precaution that, you know, collector man who has to like unfortunately get rid of his collection is doing versus the label. It's just like, fuck it, here, it's in a mailing envelope.
Seven inches are almost indestructible compared to LPs. If you sit down in an LP, it's screwed. 7 inches, I don't know if it's just because they're smaller or what, but they're much tougher.
I mean, this one looks amazing. I mean, I'm not.
Plus,
wanna...
the covers aren't as. It's not the same because usually a lot of times they're just like folded up covers. You know, they don't have the spines and all that. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
it'll be fine.
This thing is just like the difference in perceived care, I think, was the thing that I thought was really funny. So, anyways, I bought records, John.
I bought some tickets.
Well, that's good. Tom, you want to go or you want me to go?
I don't care.
Okay. Well,
I've only got a couple things. Why don't you go ahead, Jeff?
Okay. Well, speaking of what's the word I'm looking for? Disturbed guys singing gospel music. I picked up something very rare and very unusual, though I think this is going to be a flipper. I got an original press, or rather original dubbing, handmade version of Daniel Johnston's Hi, How Are You album on cassette. And, of course, with the original ones, the track list is handwritten by Daniel Johnston. The tape is handwritten by him, and it's assembled by – like, it's essentially glued together by him. And so – that's a pretty cool thing. But the thing is I mean, I like Daniel Johnston, but I'm not a mega fan, so I think I might have to flip this bad boy. But it is cool to see, like, a handmade item by a musical legend put together. You know what I'm saying? Here's an interesting thing. Tom, are you a Judas Priest fan?
Yes.
Yeah, I love Judas Priest. Is either my favorite or second favorite heavy metal band. And the famous thing, one of the famous things about
they're touring. They're doing a 50th anniversary tour this year, John. Did you see that?
Well, I'm going to be there.
I probably will too.
One of the interesting things about Judas Priest is they famously had a terrible, terrible record deal, and so their first two albums are held by a different party than all the other albums. The first two records are held by a pretty fishy company called Gull Records. The first one is Rock-A-Rolla. The second is Sad Wings of Destiny. When I was younger, I hated Rock-A-Rolla, but after I got into Pink Floyd and that kind of stuff, I actually love Rock-A-Rolla now, and also I really like – well, actually, I always – Sad Wings of Destiny is a total classic. But anyway, the issue with Rock-A-Rolla is that many people think that it was mastered weird and sounds bad or sounds weird and unusual, and that's because the label messed with the mix and remastered it in the 70s, that is. After the band was done with it, and because the label totally owned it, the band couldn't do anything. There is a compilation. It's a shady compilation put out by Gold Records, licensed to many different, you know, shady record labels, called Hero Hero. And it's called The Best of Judas Priest, but it isn't really. It's really just all of the first album and half of the second album, because that's the only material the Gold Records owns. The interesting thing about this is it includes the original mix of the first album, but it's all cut up and spread across different tracks because they put together some of the tracks from the second album. But if you were this is not your first step as a Judas Priest fan, but if you are a Judas Priest fan, you should seek out – you have to get the original version. I got the original Spanish version just because it was $10. But you should get the original – because the later day pressings use the album mastering. But if you get the original pressing from whatever country, it sounds totally different and honestly sounds – a lot more muscular and sounds a lot more Black Sabbath-y. So that's always a weird and interesting thing to do, is you find different versions of semi-legendary albums. The last thing that I'm going to mention is, you know, I used to talk about the dollar bin all the time, and I realized I don't really talk about the dollar bin as much anymore or at all. And the reason is because
they've been picked clean, John. They've been picked clean. I can't find anything good anymore.
They have been picked clean, and honestly, like, the price of records have shot way up in the past 5 or 6 or 7 years. So things that used to be in the dollar bin are in like the $5, $10, or even $15 bin now. Not that there's a $15 bin, but so I haven't gotten like anything amazing out of the dollar bin for a couple of years. I've gotten some cool stuff here and there, but nothing like amazing. However, I was at Sit and Spin Records, great record store in Philadelphia, and I was flipping through the discount rack. And there's been a record sitting there since September 2019. So that's not that long ago. But it was discounted from $4 to $2. And it was called the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the cover looked kind of new wavy, but it could have been new wavy. It could have been Prague. It could have been anything. I flipped it over. I see what year it comes out. It came out in 1980. I'm like, you know what, for $2, it's got tracks called Drafted, Z-Bomb, Fax, Critical Mass, System Failure, Nothing is the Same, White Sugar. I'm buying this record for $2. And if it's shitty, whatever, it's $2. But if it's awesome, then it's awesome. And get this, boys. This band that no one really knows about, it's on Discogs, but like no one gives a shit about it. This record is awesome. This record is a really, really, really cool new wave record. I'm not gonna say it's like the best record ever, but if you like new wave, this record is primo. And maybe I'll play a track later on during the podcast. The interesting thing about this is there's a track called Drafted, and the first line is, I got a letter from the government, and then the refrain is drafted. Tom, I know you're a Public Enemy fan. Does that have any significance to you?
I'm a very, very I am a Public Enemy fan, but I'm a very casual Public Enemy fan. I wouldn't like to be quizzed about it.
It does not. One of the most famous Public Enemy songs is Black Steel in an Hour of Chaos. And the song is about Chuck D. They're trying to draft him, and he says, I'm not going to Vietnam. So they put him in jail, and he breaks out. And the first line is, I got a letter from the government. They wanted me, or something along those lines. And it's about being drafted. And I'm like, oh, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Public Enemy must be referencing the same song. I would assume they was referencing like some songs from the 60s or something. I Googled it. The internet thinks that Chuck D wrote that line. But I think Chuck D has this record and where this record. I mean, it could be a coincidence, but the first line of both songs is, I got a letter from the government and it's about being drafted. Like I don't know. That's kind of, I mean, and of course, I'm not saying Chuck D ripped off the band because hip hop is about taking other sources and stitching it together. But I think what's interesting is I think Chuck D knows this new wave record.
I will
ask him on Twitter. Sometimes he answers, sometimes he doesn't. I will ask him and we'll report back if he answers. Tommy, getting cool records lately?
I got a couple records, and you know, I've been buying too many records lately. I've been obsessively hunting a lot of 7-inches, but you know, I kind of talked to, I can't remember if we've talked about this or not, but it's like record stores. Pardon me, boys. Record stores seem to be horrible at selling me 7-inches. So I've been buying the vast majority of my 7-inches on Discogs. My local record stores carry them, but either they're very difficult to see and barely organized, or they just don't have a very good selection at all. So on Discogs, I've been buying 7-inches. I've been picking up LPs at the record store. I got two things recently we're talking about. I was out with my wife doing some antiquing and our normal thing and digging through box after box of like Bobby Vinton, the Polish Prince records and things, finding absolutely nothing. You know, Adam was talking about the record fairs, how it's all like 70s stuff. You go to like most of the secondhand places or antique places, it's all these freaking 50s crooners records. You see that stuff, John?
Oh, all the time.
It's the worst. I see places trying to sell that stuff for like $5. They can't even sell it for $1. Literally, no one wants that stuff. You might as well just take it to the landfill. But anyway, but I was right around the corner from the Grand Rapids has two big record stores. One of them is really great punk metal, just a great record store geared towards younger people. But there's another one that's really cool too, but is geared towards everybody, you know, much more kind of common interest, but they might have 100,000 records in there, John. I've never seen anything like this. They have so many records, but I really didn't want to spend a ton of money. So I went through them all and I grabbed Sorry Ma, Forgot to Take Out the Trash, the very first Replacements album.
Was that like super expensive?
No, it was a repress. Oh. Twin Tone, the original label, you know, the original Minneapolis label. And I was carrying it out And I think when most people think of the Replacements, they think of like that later college era stuff. But the first record especially was really a great punk record, no question about it. And I'm carrying it out, and then I went back and I put it down and I grabbed Evil Eye, or I grabbed Earth AD, which I've had on CD for years, but I got to tell you, the record does sound better. I mean, the mixing or something is better than it is on the CD. It's clearer. So anyway, I bought Earth AD, which I needed like a hole in the head, because I think that's second or third. It's at least the second time I bought it, maybe the third. And I also bought something about, but what can I say? Tang Records is kind of notorious for not paying their bands. I don't know if you know anything about Tang at all, but
I went to Tang Records once. I don't even think it's anymore in San Diego, and like.
They have a store. I think they still have a store, but I'm not sure.
Not a great record store.
I heard the same thing about Doctor Strange, and it made me so sad because these are places that I mail ordered from Tang quite a bit over the years. Their mail order prices are really good.
Yeah, when you don't pay anybody.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, right? So they repressed the second Sloppy Seconds album, which is called Knock Your Block Off. It's not nearly as magical as their first album, Destroy, but it's got some good stuff on it, and it's a classic. So they repressed that in a clear yellow for Record Store Day 1 year. I don't know if it was 18 or 19 or what year it was. And I felt kind of bad about getting it because I know the band hasn't been paid for it. I mean, I literally heard from the band themselves that they weren't getting paid for it. And the only reason they found out they even knew it was repressed was because they ran across a copy of it at a store. So I did get the clear yellow copy on Tang of Knock Your Block Off by Sloppy Seconds. So yeah, I bought two records of things I already had. Congratulations to me. I didn't buy some new wave record because it was $2. I paid $20 for records I already have.
Well, you know, that's the rule is honestly, with regards to records, rarity, price, and quality of record, there's almost no correlation at all. Although Sloppy Sack is a very cool band. Earth Lady is amazing. Anyways, let's play a song. Who wants to play a track?
John, or I'll play. No. Okay. This is for you. It's been for you since I came across it, so I just have to get it out. There's a band. Now they're from Vancouver, but don't hold that against them. There's a band from Vancouver called.
Could just as easily have picked a band from Ohio.
But I wouldn't have heard of them because I don't care. Yeah. So there's a band from Vancouver called The Judges, and The Judges, John, are
straight edge band from New York.
They are four people who happen to be various like lifer vets of the local punk and metal scenes there. And they got together one day and they decided, we're going to make a band. We are going to play entirely while wearing black judge robes and old school British judge wigs.
That's amusing. I'm down.
And all of our songs are going to be about the law and various judge stuff. So they just released a live record called A Live Sentence that is them playing all of a bunch of their judge songs. There are two covers on the record. The two covers are very indicative of what the judges do because A, they are songs that could be by the judges given the subject matter of those songs. But B, they sound like all the bands that the judges are trying to sound like. So on this cover record, or on this record, amongst their set, they cover Public Hangings by Fear.
Mm.
Because, you know, a judge would sentence that. And they cover Deny Everything by the Circle Jerks.
Ah!
Because someone in court might deny everything. And everything else on here is just a random song that has a judge theme to it. And everything they play is ridiculous and dumb, and I kind of love it. So, John, just based on song title alone, do you want to hear Fresh Justice, Useless Witness, Exhibit A, What's Under the Robe?
What's Under the Robe? Bam! What's right
Under
there.
The Robe? All right. Bam. Here we go. This is The Judges and What's Under the Robe. We'll be back in less than 2 minutes.
All right, this next one's called What's Under the Robe.
And that was The Judges doing What's Under the Robe. Very amusing, Adam. Good choice, I will say. We're running a little bit behind, so we're going to slam through some articles and get to it.
They should cover Adam. You know what they should cover? You should let them know that they should cover "You Have the Right to Remain Violent" by Slapshot.
I'm sure they have a list somewhere. There is a shared Google Doc that goes between the members of the judges.
They see a song and they're like, "Oh, I better write that down." Okay.
Speaking of Boston bands, the Dropkick Murphys and Rancid are going on tour, and it's a pretty massive tour. It kicks off in it's only 3 weeks. Let's see. It kicks off in May, and it runs through May. It's a month long. Anyways, it's called Boston to Berkeley 2. It's a sequel to last year's tour, the year before's tour, that was those two bands joining up. But here's the question that everybody's asking, and by everybody I mean me. Is this the tour of the summer? Two punk legends come together and combining their powers for the big punk tour, the big punk show of the summer? Or is this two old farts farting around, doing what they always do, being uninspired and you know, just playing the same old tracks? Adam.
Why does it have to be either or?
Well, it could be both, couldn't it?
I don't know. I'm tempted these days to look at anything that Rancid is doing not through the lens of my super fucking pumped about Rancid youth, but more through the lens of my whatever horrible thing I am these days. I don't want to look at it with fun. I kind of want to look at it with like some level of derision and I don't know. But here's the thing. So I of course saw this. I saw the art. I saw the goofy little video that announces it. And I thought to myself, like, oh, old dads, I get you. You fucking old people at this point. Like, whatever. I don't care. But then I saw that the last date on this tour is in Lewiston, New York. And I don't know if you know anything about Lewiston, New York, but it's right across the border, more or less, from Niagara Falls, at least portions of thereof. And like, I could go to that. I could go to that show. I could go to that show in like 25 minutes, as long as there isn't like some sort of border incident. And I'm like, wow, maybe I should go. Maybe I should go see the Boston to Berkeley tour.
Because I had never heard of that town before.
Lewiston is directly across from a small town that is part of Niagara Falls and Niagara on the Lake called Queenston. So there's a border bridge between the two of them, which is the Queenston-Lewiston Bridge, which is a bridge that is mostly used by transport trucks, but is a bridge that people could drive over. And anyways, yeah, that's where Lewiston is.
So
but there's the,
it,
yeah.
It definitely seems like they're hitting. I mean, there's some big towns on it. They're doing Atlanta and I can't remember Houston or something. But it looked like a lot of secondary cities maybe that they missed when they did this a couple years ago. That's kind of my guess, but I might be wrong about that. But they're doing Grand Rapids. Of course, they're doing Grand Rapids on a Monday night.
They're
doing Grand Rapids on a Monday night, and it might be the birthday of a certain has-been punk rocker who will be turning, holy cow, 47.
Ooh.
Yes. And may also go be at that show downing shotgunning beers. Rancid has not played in Grand Rapids since 1996.
What's this crazy story there. You were talking about? You said, oh, man, who remembers the crazy time at Grand Rapids?
No, I was actually talking to a guy from Grand Rapids in the comments. And there's a reason it's kind of legendary, because Lars stole a bunch of records from a local punk.
And he still
kind of carries a grudge about it.
He stole his
Celtic Frost records.
Wow, that's lame. But how do you get in his house?
They were staying there or hanging out there or something. That was the punk house in town. They were still hanging out at the punk house, even though they were playing bigger bars. But they weren't like a huge headliner at that point yet, you know?
I'm looking at Lewistown, New Jersey, or New York, rather. There is an absolutely amazing garden there that has a bunch of Greek-style statues. It's amazing.
That's where Rancid's playing.
If I have my U.S. towns on the border correct,
I believe in Lewiston, New York. So first of all, they're playing the place in Lewiston. They're playing is a place called Art Park, which is outside, which would be kind of fun. So it's not like it's not in a fucking House of Blues or anything. So that's
they're playing a dumpy old rundown hockey rink here.
So they are playing an outdoor show, which would be kind of cool. But in so in Lewiston, New York, I believe, unless I'm mixing up my towns, is the hometown of my God, I can't believe I'm forgetting her name. I love Lucy. What's her name?
Lucille Ball.
And there is the American Museum of Comedy or something like that is apparently there because of her. Let's see, Lucille Ball. Is that Lewiston or is that some other place?
Well, why Adam's looking up the hits of the 50s comedy.
Jamestown? What the fuck?
Buzz Osborne is putting out a new solo LP. And I don't know.
What's that town, Adam? It's okay.
I don't know if Adam or Tom will have anything to say about this, but there's I'll give you guys a little bit of, not inside info, but unreported info. So this is Buzz Osborne's second solo album. His first was called This Machine Kills Artists. The new one is called Gift of Sacrifice, which is a pretty cool title. It's basically mostly an acoustic album with Trevor Dunn on stand-up bass. Trevor Dunn is part of one of the versions of the Melvins called Melvin's Light, which is Buzz Osborne, Dale Crover, and Trevor Dunn. And they're all interesting versions. Reportedly, Dale Crover was having back issues last year, which is why the Melvins didn't tour too much last year. They only did, say, 70 days instead of 150 or 200. And that's why they only put out 3 EPs instead of 3 albums like they usually do, 2 or 3 albums. Now Buzz Osborne's putting out a solo LP, and right now there's no necessarily words of new Melvins material coming out, but there's always rumors of stuff in the works. I hope that this is not a signifier that Dale Crover is not doing well or that he can't tour anymore, and it just, you know, the next thing that the Melvins are up to. I would be very sad, and I'm not trying to start any rumors, but it's somewhat, I guess, suspicious that Osborne is doing a 3-month tour with Trevor Dunn and not as the Melvins. So I don't know. I'm excited for the release, though.
So speaking of Grand Rapids, Buzz loves Grand Rapids. He plays here every year, which is not to say that there aren't other cities like that, but I see he's doing solo at the Pyramid Scheme. The Melvins have played 3 years in a row or something at the Pyramid Scheme, including last year. So Buzz is coming to town, John. Do I need to go see him?
Yes.
I've never seen him solo.
If you go see him solo on his last solo tour, he gave you the inside dirt. Like it was cool, but it was kind of
really
weird.
Because when they played like then the Mel last time I saw the Melvins, I don't believe he spoke one word. No, right. I don't think so.
The Buzz Osborne show was totally
different. He dressed like he was not like he was the alien who was gonna give you an anal probe. He literally was wearing like some kind of a silver jumpsuit or something.
If you go see the Melvins, they just kick ass and it's amazing. But if you go see Buzz Osborne solo, it's totally different, at least for the first tour. He came out, he like kind of talked to people, he played some songs, he told some stories, and man, he talked smack on Dave Grohl a lot. And I gotta say, Dave Grohl might not be the person that people think he is. Meanwhile, he also gave, like I'm not necessarily a Mike Patton fan, but he went on about how good of a guy Mike Patton and how genuine a guy Mike Patton really is. And there's other stories, too. So, I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see. Speaking of waiting to see, I don't know if Adam or Tom or Adam have any perspective on this. This is a sticky situation. Now that Brexit has been voted and approved by the UK, we are currently in the transitional period. If you're an intellectual property guy, that means actually intellectual property issues are going to be handled totally different at the end of this year with regards to Britain and the EU than they were previously. But anyways, Britain is leaving the EU. That means that European bands that are now going to tour the UK will have to get visas. The entry fee is rather expensive. It's £244, which is almost like $400. Maybe that's like $370. So it's pretty expensive to get a visa. To tour the country, and a lot of people are upset. However, anybody from any other country, this is what they would have to go through too. So now the EU is being treated as any other country would be treated as before. So I don't really know if this is news. And Pitchfork was the first to report this as news. I don't know if it's news. It's just saying that as to the surprise of no one, UK will be treating EU as it treats any other country. I mean, I realize the EU is not a country, but it is a unit. So UK will be treating EU or people from countries in the EU as any other country and not specifically under EU regulations or WIPO regulations. So I don't know if you guys, and you know, Brexit, generally punks are anti-Brexit, but I know some punks that are actually very pro-Brexit, and it's really across the board as the people's perspectives. And some very conservative people are anti-Brexit, some very conservative people are very pro-Brexit, and vice versa. So I don't know if you guys have any opinion on this, or will this affect musicians? I mean, honestly, it's not going to affect North American musicians touring Britain because they always had to pay these fees anyways. But I don't know if you guys have any perspective.
And we're used to having a passport to go pretty much everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know. The kids seem to be really upset about it. The older people are not too upset about it. I only know a couple of English people, and they were pro-Brexit, I think. I don't know. It seems absurd to us, being as independent as we are as a country, to tie our economic fate to countries that aren't as sound, but I'm sure there's good reasons to do that too. So I don't know. I don't really have a strong opinion about it, but
yeah, I am not an expert on this, so I'm not going to give an opinion on Brexit, but I agree with Tom in that most of the British people that I know are pro Brexit, while I hear most of the anti-Brexits. A conversation coming from North American people, interestingly enough. Adam, solve Brexit.
I mean, I'll weigh in on the visa thing. I don't want to weigh in on Brexit because that's not really my bag to weigh in on. I mean, my colloquial read on it is a little bit different from, I think, your guys, in that most of the pro Brexit stuff that I've heard are from old people, and most of the anti is from young people, where mobility in Europe would have been
they're used to it too.
So, I mean, but hey, what that's not my fight. We have enough fucking problems in our stupid land right now.
We got enough problems. We don't need to be worried about Britain right now. You know what I
mean? Yeah, we had our own burning trash piles right now. So you guys can have your own. But I think that from a Canadian standpoint, this is kind of interesting because the presence of a hard border between two areas makes an insane amount of difference when it comes to the not only like the health of an artistic scene, I'm not too pessimistic on that standpoint, because I think that like art can kind of crop up and thrive anywhere, but the character of an art scene is absolutely forged by those sort of like real world barriers. And this plays like 100% into all of my Canadian music stuff that I've been working on, which is to say that you can go and you can look at, say, if you want to use Canada as an example of somewhere where there was a hard border, right? So there's a hard border between Canada and the US in that, like, there's no free travel over the border. You have to go through customs or whatever else. You can't go to the United States or to Canada, for that matter, as a musician to perform or, you know, do anything in the public eye, because you are seen as a laborer crossing into the other country to, you know, if you want to take the standpoint of these crusty border guards, you are going over there to take American gerbs, right? In the same way that anyone crossing the border to labor in the country is. And if you want to do it, you have to have purchased and have in good standing order the same kinds of like work visas that other laborers coming into the country would have to have. It's not, you can't just get by at the border because, oh, well, you know, we're going to play rock songs in a bar, so that's cool. It's not like we're not going to come work in your factories, right? We're going to come play songs in a bar. That, like, as far as the board is concerned, like, work is work. So you're coming into the country, you're coming in as labor, you are affected by all those kinds of rules, which means that you can't, without lying, casually cross the border. Now, I can casually cross the border in that I can totally go to the border and say, I'm going to go to buy milk in Niagara Falls, New York. And they go, okay. And I go over the border and buy milk in Niagara Falls, New York. But if I was going to go over there and I had a guitar in my trunk and I'm like, I'm going to go play like guitar for you know, 35 minutes at the anchor bar and then come home. That would be a problem because like I'm going there to work and you are in a whole different category of scrutiny at that point. So that little hump, and by little hump, I was trying to look it up while we were talking, but it's kind of hard to figure out. But I'm pretty sure if you're a Canadian musician going to work in the US, you need something called a P2 work visa, which is like at least $1,500, as you know, probably for the year as far as what you need to go over there. And comes with all sorts of other kind of like scrutiny of applying for border crossing documents. So if you're a band and there's four of you in a band, right? You know, you want to go cross the border and play, right? Like all of a sudden you were talking about a significant amount of money, especially as far as a band that does not make any money is concerned. And usually when you're crossing the border to do this shit too, you are crossing the border as you, the things that you would kind of take as verbatim in your own territory all of a sudden isn't. So yeah, you might be able to get a work visa to go across the border to perform, but can you cross the border and also have, you know, 300 t-shirts in a box that you're intending to sell at your shows? Like maybe not. That's a whole other can of worms that you start to having to deal with, because all of a sudden you're importing stuff. So that means if you're going to cross the border and do things, you can't just move with your merch. It probably means that you're reordering your merch from somewhere in the States and then picking it up when you get over there and yada, yada, yada. And it affects the kind of stuff that you do, because if it is going to cost that much for you to go over the border and perform, well, you can't just do it flippantly. Like you want to make sure you're doing it on a tour that's going to be significant enough to make it worth your while to apply for that shit in the first place. You know, like you aren't just going over every 5 months to play right over the border. Like you're going to go over for a 2-3 month tour if you can swing it. So what all that means is it is a lot easier, especially given the economics of bands these days, to not have to deal with that shit. So, and to not have to deal with that shit means that you make do with what you've got, and that creates some weird stuff. So there are, again, in the Canadian standpoint, there's a huge scene. Like there are interconnected, you know, tendrils of bands between somewhere like, say, Ottawa, Ontario, and Halifax, Nova Scotia. And those places are, let's see, how far are they away? If you were to drive from Ottawa to Halifax, driving, this is where I search Google on the show, is a 14-hour drive and 6 minutes, right? To go from Ottawa to Halifax. Now, those are places that are fucking far enough apart that in any generic place in the States that is 14 hours from somewhere else, you would not have like a functioning scene with a lot of interchange between those two places. But it's a lot less, it's a lot less chaos to go from Halifax to Ottawa than it would be to go from, say, Ottawa to anywhere that is way less than 14 hours away that is over the border into the States. So like the whole reason that there is any sort of Canadian scene in the first place is because of the border, and because of going over it is a pain. If there was a fucking NAFTA provision where they said, like, you know what, like we understand the value of artistic exchange, and if you're going over to play music, then you can just go over like a normal person and it doesn't matter. The notion that there is a Canadian scene would evaporate. Because you wouldn't need it. It would be geographically untenable. But with the border in place, that's sort of a pain in the ass. So, you know, we make do with what we got. And you know, you kind of make your shit under the circumstances. So what this is going to mean is it's going to mean you're going to have a lot of people that probably had an interconnected artistic scene with the UK not having that anymore, and it creating a different relationship on either side, where, and especially like, let's say you were a UK band and you did pretty well in Belgium. Well, you might not be able to do that anymore. So you're going to kind of have to like find your new people, or you're going to have to pay up. And, you know, given that bands make no money these days, find your new people is probably the better option. So yeah, this stuff matters. It's not, I don't want to necessarily approach it and be like, it's the worst thing ever to happen, because again, artists and art scenes are adaptable, and you kind of like you fill the space that you're given, but it will definitely change things. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of things that'll change things, the proliferation of nuclear technology certainly has changed things. So I'm going to play a track by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I don't know which one, because I don't know which ones are on YouTube, because it's a relatively obscure record. Anyway, this is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They only put out one record, and if you see it for 2 hours, you should get it.
No lie, one of my favorite drugs that makes me hot.
And we're back, and we're running long, so we're just going to blow through a couple of things here. I guess two things we're going to blow through, and then if you guys want to address the other two, we can. First thing, Lotion, a synth-punk band from New York. has put out a discography, but the only kicker is the discography is available as a rubber USB bracelet. And I bought one when I saw Lotion this past weekend with Mean Jeans, Dark Thoughts, and Strike Anywhere. And it's got, I don't know, 100 tracks on it, 150 tracks on it. It's got a lot of music. They're only charging $15. This is cool and weird. Lotion's an awesome band. Is this a cool thing, or is this just a dumb gimmick that's a waste of product?
I'm for any band selling weird stuff, and I intend one day to have just like a whole shelf full of it. There was an artist I saw the other day that was like she was making like traditional Colombian candles and selling them alongside her records, and I was like, deal, I want some candles.
Is that Christy Road?
No, it was Lito Pineda. But I'm there and I'm like, what can I buy from you right now that is like super interesting to me? And I'm like, you know what? Like, candles made by this musician is more interesting to me at the moment than buying a CD.
Tom, you're like me. You're a vinyl and CD guy. Would you want a USB? I mean, because like you plug it in your computer once, you take everything off of it, and then you put it back on the shelf and then look at it. So as far as a physical medium, it's not really, really a physical medium. You know what I mean? So, Tom, is this attractive to you, or would you not care about this?
Nah, I don't care about this.
So you think only CD and records is the only way to go?
Yes.
Why?
And I've become, because I don't want to listen to music through a computer.
Yeah.
I'm just not interested in that. I mean, do I sometimes? Yes. I'll listen to a YouTube video or something, but to listen to a whole album? Nah, not for me.
Yeah, but I agree. What I used to do is I download it to an MP3 player, or even I burn it to a CD and I listen to it that way. You know, but honestly, like when you have a burnt CD, it just feels crappier than like a real CD. You know what I mean? I don't care as much.
Yeah. I've gotten pretty bad at only pretty much listen to vinyl at home. I think I probably already told this story. I had a really nice CD player. It was actually like a 2-tray burnable CD player, Sony. It had a really nice display and all that, and it took a dump, and I just bought like a cheap DVD player to replace it because my stereo is so old that like the new audio equipment won't interface with it, my receiver. And I don't enjoy listening to CDs anymore because there's no display.
Do you guys think that $15 for your entire discography, are you doing yourself harm with that?
Not if nobody's buying it otherwise. I mean, how many songs are we talking about, John? How many songs?
About 100, maybe 75. A lot. You know, like way more than 15, you know?
You see that all the time. The people on Bandcamp, they're like, oh, get our whole discography for
$10. I wonder if artists as a collective have shot themselves in the foot. And I wonder if they held strong and said, no, this is worth $12, you know? And not. I wonder if they would all be better off if they all had held strong, you know? Or would people just stop listening to that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's funny. You see, I don't know. Supply and demand, I guess, right? I don't know.
Well, let's look at the exact opposite from the minimalism of Lotion. Let's go to maximalism. The Stooges are going to release a 50th anniversary of what many people consider the greatest album ever made. I might agree. Funhouse is getting a 50th anniversary reissue. The original album is getting split across two LPs as opposed to the original one LP, and it's going to play at 45 RPM. So that means basically, I guess it means there's only two songs per side, really, because there's only 8 songs on Funhouse, or 7. There's 7 songs on Funhouse. It also comes with, however, the complete Funhouse Sessions, which was released as a massive CD box set about 10 or 15 years ago. So that's about another 8 records or so right there. It also comes with 2 7-inch singles, a book, and other novelties. I don't think anybody ever really does anything with the novelties ever, except for look at them and put them back in the box, you know. Surprisingly to me, I was getting heat in the comments section over posting this article at all. And I'm like, it's the Stooges. Like, how can you attack the Stooges, you know? Meanwhile, are you guys interested in this box set? Would you be interested in this box set? Also, it comes with their live album, Live at Ugano's, which was released before, which actually, despite the subpar sound quality, is an excellent, excellent live album, and it's the live album from the release show of Funhouse. I'll go first. I would not buy it. I mean, if someone gave it to me, I would take it, but I would not. I mean, like not everything needs to be pressed on vinyl, especially when it wasn't on vinyl to begin with. The complete Funhouse Sessions is not an album. It's like 4 reels of just the same song recorded seven different times. You know, I Got It Right eight times. Down on the Street seven times. 1970 10 times. Like you'll listen to that like once, maybe you'll listen to that once. If I got it, I will never listen to it because famously the best versions are the album versions, and the other takes are quite famously subpar. So, but like the Funhouse sessions were never on vinyl to begin with, and they're very, very long. So why specifically put them on a format to not only which they're not suited for, which kind of distorts what they were originally, and also is very expensive. This just seems kind of dumb to me, honestly. I mean, I'm not gonna like write letters to my local senator, but I mean, like, I just think this is stupid. And, like,
so we've reached peak vinyl, right, John? It's too much.
It is too like who needs the Funhouse? Like, the question is, why put the Funhouse sessions on vinyl?
So is it all? I mean, are the songs are they kind of at least put in order so that you're not listening to the same song over and over again? No, I assume
it's the CD version at least. 1970 in a row, eight times in a row. You know what I mean?
Oh, come on. Who's listening to that?
Like, no. Like, I mean, honestly, what that is, that's an archive.
Iggy's mom thinks that sucks.
What that is that's a library / archive material that definitely should be preserved and saved in an archive. Listenable. But it doesn't need to be a product. You know, like, there's no reason to make that a product.
Yeah. I like these deluxe box sets, but I never pay for them. I mean, I think they're cool. Like, I looked at, like, the Metallica ones with, like, four LPs and 17 cassettes and 69 CDs and stuff. They cost $200, and they're really cool. But, I mean, yeah, seriously, who needs it? I just want the 12 tracks, you know? See,
I think those boxes are kind of dumb because they take a live album and split it across, like, four records. That's stupid. Like a live show is essentially one side of a record, if that makes sense. It's one continuous thing. So why would you put it on a format that specifically has many breaks in it? For me... Max out CDs for live shows. That makes way more sense than putting two or three live songs on a record. Then you got to flip it over. Then you got to get out the other one. It makes no sense.
If you're talking the archival material, unfortunately, you know, love them or hate them, CDs are convenient for skipping songs.
Well, they're convenient. They're also convenient in that you can put a lot of material on one disc.
Yeah.
And it's perfect for like, you know, you put the album on one CD, you put the stuff you listen to once on another CD. And that makes sense.
It's true because I have like, okay, so I have a couple of albums specifically that I can think of where I have, the Ramones reissues are a good one. I have the Ramones reissue of Leave Home, which has like 30 songs. The Rhino reissue has like 30 songs on it because it's got the original 14 plus like the song that replaced Carbona Not Glue, which is called Babysitter, and then like a whole live show, right?
Right.
But then I also have the vinyl version, which just has the original 14 songs on it. So, like, if I'm sitting in my living room, I'm just going to throw that on. But I don't mind having the CD with the extra tracks. Or I have other, you know, classic hardcore albums that are, like, 17 minutes long. So they have the original 12 songs for 17 minutes. And then they'll have, like, a half-hour live show from the same era. But on the LP, it's just, it's just those 17 minutes. So I think I'm more flexible with them screwing with the CD than I am with the LP format, I guess.
Adam had some kind of interjection there.
No, I was basically in a way agreeing with you in that I don't want them to fuck around with the original CD, the original LP, whatever it is. Like, I don't want the original runtime of the album. I would like to be left alone and not augmented with stuff. And honestly, this is one of these places where I can see there being a nice hybrid model. Like, you know what? If you are going to go and do a really nice high quality pressing of Funhouse, hey, you know what? Let's say you're even going to do a pressing of Funhouse at 45 RPM, right? So you get it spread over a couple more discs. You know, you get big, deep, fat grooves on that record, so you can, you know, whatever audiophile horseshit you can do to make that better than otherwise, right? Sure. But my problem is when you do have all that archival stuff, see, I would disagree that even that really has a great place on CD. That to me is the quintessential thing that should live in a digital archive somewhere. where you're never like, because I was thinking the Ramones reissues or those the 500 versions of London Calling that exist, right? Where you have all these extra records or CDs full of shit, but you never go and sit down and listen to any of them as a contiguous piece, because what they are is just like a collection of the other stuff. And I get why they put them onto the product, because they want to make it sound like, oh, look at all the stuff you get, right? But really, you know, if you're going to go listen to one of, you know, 25 versions of a particular song, the place where you might go and listen to those and compare and contrast them in a way that is meaningful and navigatable is like some sort of internet thing. And to call back to the start of this episode, my boy Neil Young, he's got a thing. He has this like Neil Young Archives project that is, you know, I think you have to pay to get into it, but it's everything. Apparently it's every piece of audio he's ever recorded is going to be released into this heap. So if you really wanted to go here, you know, take 35 of, you know, old man, then you could go like dig your way into the pile and listen to that. And that might be more useful than it being on like CD number 6. Cause I doubt that anyone goes back to any of that shit when it's on CD or vinyl or anything like that.
Occasionally. Yeah. Well, you don't have John and I's, you know, like desire to hoard, apparently, Adam.
I mean, I have the desire to own stuff, but I have no illusion that I would ever listen to it again.
It is, like I said, it is kind of, it's tricky, and it's, I don't know. We all interact differently with different things, I guess. So,
should we shut this bad boy on down, or let's shut it on down. It's been a long episode. I think Tom, you've got a song to play if you want, and then we'll ride out on that. Before we do that, Adam, any last words? Any deluxe box sets that you want the people to go buy for you?
No, because anytime I see them, even from bands I like, they're kind of stupid.
Adam, if they came out with the complete trans sessions, would you buy that?
No.
Because, actually, that's dragging this episode out. Did you know that Trans was developed out of an album that was supposed to be like a reggae/beach-themed album? And they recorded like half of it, and then Neil went into the studio by himself, and then like erased everybody else's contributions and then made it Trans, which is cool.
But you know, all that original stuff like exists in a box somewhere in his house. So yeah, that's, I don't know. There's a lot of crazy shit that I would go listen to. I would probably not buy the complete anything sessions, because I'm pretty sure, as for any artist, be you Iggy Pop or Neil Young or whoever, all the crap that you have to churn out before you get to the good stuff is probably crap.
Adam, if Neil Young called you and said, Adam, let's hang out for the entire day, but the only thing he wants to do is sit in a living room with you and listen to like the complete harvest sessions, would you do it? Like you have to sit there and listen, and you can drink beer with him, but you have to listen to like 12 hours of harvest.
Oh, I'd do that. Come on.
I don't know if Neil Young is a beer drinker, but he does. He does share Adam's affinity for the wacky tobacco, as we call it down here in the States.
Tom Trauma, any last words? And what track should we sail on out with down on the street?
You know, it's funny because I actually don't have a track.
We can just shut it down. You know what I'm saying? We can do the punk thing and be like, screw you guys.
Well, yeah, I just, my preparation time, you know, my preparation is not great. I'll admit it.
All right. Screw you guys.
Yeah. Keep it a read.